And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm now joined by JJ Bull the Bullard.
I can't wait for the podcast, Joe!
That's right, me too. Don't have to wait any longer because we're joined by Jonathan Dog McKenzie.
I'm also very excited about this podcast, Joe.
Yay, we're all excited. And why could that be? Well, because we're excited every day that we wake up. And because the football happened over the weekend. And because...
Someone stole my cafetiere.
Someone stole JJ's cafetiere.
Is this cafetiere. A thing within an office environment where I have a cafetiere, it's clearly mine, right? Because it looks nice.
Because it's got your name on
but
it.
It's gone, it doesn't have my name on it, but it's gone missing. Someone's used it today.
I think a cafetiere, I think it's fair for one
concept
person to,
do you think it's common,
one to think, who would anyone really bring in their own cafetiere?
Yeah, several people have.
Cafetiere.
Several people have. Well, and you see, and then they would use their own one. So I'm just wondering if I'm being weird
here. Who do you suspect of the writers at The Athletic? Who do you suspect stole your cafetiere?
I don't know, but I've looked for it and I can't see who's got it.
Yeah.
So then I had to, and I spent 5 minutes. Obviously, this is very hugely problematic for me because I can't make decisions. So then I had to stare at the empty, the cupboard full of other people's cafetieres and think, but if I take someone else's, then I'm part of the problem.
That's true.
It took me a long time to figure out. I just do it really quickly.
It's like the Manchester United marking system, right? Yeah. As soon as one person messes up, then that's someone else has to mess up further
that's
down
a good,
the line.
That's
and it's funny to talk about decisions, isn't it? Because you clearly decided to kibosh my intro and you decided to rescue it.
Oh, yeah.
Someone's done it and they've not, I'm sure they've not done it on purpose, not realizing that it's a thing. But it's like when you live in a flat with all other people and then you're like, why is they taking my cheese?
Why would they take my cheese?
Yeah, that would make me laugh.
Yeah. Well, why indeed did they take the cheese? And that's what Manchester United fans are asking Liverpool fans this morning.
That wasn't English.
No, it wasn't. And that's what we discuss in today's episode. Stick with us to find out more about the cafetiere. And Arsenal leaving it as late as possible against Bournemouth. We discussed that. Can pigs eat humans? That comes up a bit later. Of course, we're joined by Sebastian Stafford Blore, Herr Blore himself, in Newcastle and their owners. We talk about that too. And of course, the interesting title races currently occurring in Serie A. Well, that's less interesting because Napoli have already won. But, you know, and the Bundesliga, where it is interesting because something is happening. There are also an excessive number of idioms in this here episode today. And we talk about West Ham a little bit later on as well, don't we?
And the ownership situation at Newcastle.
Yeah, I already said
you
that.
You already said that.
Oh, okay.
You're not listening, are you?
Well, in the first intro, we didn't remember that. So I'm just making sure that in the 18th intro that we are currently doing.
And good that you're making a cock of the 18th intro by not paying attention.
Yes, it's my fault that this intro has gone to 18 iterations. I apologize.
That's right. And if you like things that run smoothly and aren't interrupted by John McKenzie, then you should visit The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. TheAthletic.com/TIFO, where you can get a free trial, I believe, for a whole of 30 days. And you can bear witness to the incredible, miraculous writings of many of the authors at the company. And of course, also, you can read from time to time Sebastian Stafford Blore. Sometimes JJ and John write things on there as well. It's really good. And if you don't like it, you can just cancel it before the 30 days is up. And your sign-up still counts in my favour. Yeah, very exciting. Very exciting. That's theathletic.com/TIFO. But for now, I will leave you on the warm hands and the cool embrace of chaos. Okay, well, we did have other plans for where to begin today's podcast, but of course, Sunday obliterated all of those plans. And I'm speaking, JJ Bull, of Liverpool 7. 7. Nil Manchester United. Now, that is some result, isn't it?
Is it not the biggest defeat or equaled biggest defeat Man United have ever had.
It is very possible that's the case.
In the league, certainly. And it's the biggest Liverpool have ever beaten Man United by.
Yes, I would certainly not be surprised by that. Now, we had John covering the game for us yesterday, so we're going to come to him to talk about some of the tactical minutiae shortly. But what the hell happened?
Well, the thing is, for me, that I thought it was quite even in the first half. And I thought the way that United set up, first 15 minutes, you keep it slow, like try and calm the crowd down, just try and take any animosity and energy out of it. We know that Liverpool rely on intensity, so if you can do anything to try and numb that, then good. Mm-hmm. And then they were all right. Like, nothing wrong with the team selection. Seemed like a sensible thing to do, apart from Bruno Fernandes on the left, which is something they changed at the very start, and there'll be reasons for that. And then United could have taken the lead with that Rashford chance, which I think he should probably have done better with. And then they get towards half-time, Liverpool score one of their chances. What was the first goal again? Who scored it? It was
Gakpo.
It was the kind of cut inside.
The lovely Robertson pass.
After the Robertson pass.
Yeah, so there you go. And then Gakpo gets in the lead. And then whatever happens during halftime, no idea. Because what happens afterwards is that Luke Shaw appears to have, like, someone switched him off at halftime and he's still out on the pitch. Like, someone's controlling him, but he's not there. Like, he's on standby. Bruno Fernandes is going around waving his arms and gesturing at everyone to do things that they're not doing. But basically, it's a capitulation, and it's... Ten Hag called it unprofessional in his post-match interviews, and I'd say he's probably right. That you shouldn't fall apart like that. It's players not being in the right place at the right time. The first goal to give away after half-time is Shaw just passing it inside, not even blindly. I don't like using the word lazy to talk about footballers, because they're not lazy, right? Mm. But it's like, well, I don't know what he's thinking, because he must see that that's a bad pass inside the pitch from where he is, especially in the...
It's certainly a risky pass. It's the kind of pass where if it comes off and you knit through, you know, decapitate a whole half of Liverpool's defence, but it was not the right pass to make at that moment.
But it's not even that. Like, you know, Liverpool are going to try and show you to a certain bit so they can press you through the middle, and he passes exactly where they're going to be. And then this is other examples of particularly Shaw really... It's not even out of position, just not reacting to things. I think Rashford wasn't great defensively. Mm. I think Anthony got hooked off at some point, didn't he? They took him away. Yeah. Ferran
had quite a poor game, a little bit of a wobbly game as well.
But I think the thing with defenders, you can say that individually, the centre-backs, I don't think they did too much wrong individually. They're trying to constantly look around to see where things are. I think Casemiro was still in the right place at the right time, but just things weren't bouncing off him. And then you get this momentum where every time Liverpool went forward, you felt like they were going to score. It just happens sometimes where you just know that nothing you do can stop it. There's no way to stop it.
There's a difference, though, between not being able to stop it and then just and letting it happen, right? I mean, what happened in the second half to Manchester United? We talk about why maybe they were slightly more even in the first half. We had conversations yesterday around, like, is this a kind of a significant cause for concern? Are there kind of structural reasons why this took place? Is this likely to happen again? It might have been different in how it played out from the Brentford game in the first half of the season, John. But the key thing about that Brentford game was that they conceded four goals in the first half and then they didn't concede again. Whereas in this game, they conceded one goal in the first half and it just got worse and worse and worse until the game was over. Luke Shaw, again, I don't want to pick on him specifically because there were a number of players who had very bad performances, of course, for a team to concede so many goals. But Luke Shaw is quite a good example of a player who many people have been saying this season has had one of his best seasons ever. People are talking about him as one of the best fullbacks in the world, and he just completely switched off. This team appears to have that in them, doesn't they? Doesn't they? Do they? Don't they?
Yeah, I think a nice comparison is the difference between the first Manchester derby and the second Manchester derby. So in the first Manchester derby, I think City ended up winning 6-3. And they were well ahead. And I think Manchester United got a couple of goals back towards the end. And then obviously Manchester United won the other fixture 2-1. and I think that is indicative of the fine lines that exist in the way that Manchester United play football, particularly out of possession. So this is what I focused on in my video, was that actually Manchester United were actually very aggressive out of possession. They play this system which allows them to go player for player in lots of situations. It does introduce a weakness, which I thought Liverpool exploited quite well in the first half. That was what led to the first goal. So Manchester United they have a front three against a back four. And what they do is when the ball goes one side, they shift their three across and they leave the far-sided fullback free. And the idea is that they have these certain like buffers to if the ball is played to that player to account for it.
Kind of a funny thing to happen against Liverpool, given that over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, the one thing you don't do is leave the fullbacks free. Yeah. Isn't that fair to say?
I think so, yeah. And look, I've been talking about this for a good few months now about this happening, because I focus on our possession stuff quite a lot. And I've had conversations with lots of smart Man United fans about why leave that fullback free. Why not? Usually in those sorts of really aggressive systems, what you do is you just push your own fullback up onto the fullback in those situations and say, okay, this is quite it's an aggressive way of playing, because you're taking a player out of your back line, pushing them up. But for whatever reason, Erik ten Hag doesn't like to do that. And so I think we're seeing a lot of teams being able to exploit that. So in the second game against Barcelona, for example, Barcelona played much better in the first half of the second leg because they had that out ball all the time. They were able to find that free fullback. But the problem for me is that what ends up happening is when you play player for player, what you're doing is you're just setting up a series of 1v1 matchups across the field. And you're making your defensive structure dependent on all of those 1v1 duels always being won by your players. Now, that's fine when you're Manchester United, because they do have really, really good 1v1 footballers. So I talked in the video about how Wout Weghorst being dropped into the central midfield area seems like a weird move to make when this guy's been brought in to play as a nine. But I think the difference is that Wout Weghorst is much better in 1v1 matchups than Bruno Fernandes is, for example. Bruno Fernandes is a very mobile player, and I think a smart player as well. So you can play him in those wide areas, and he can do the thing where you're sort of jumping between the outside centre back and the fullback. But you want to get your player Fred, Casemiro, Weghorst. They're all very good 1v1 matchup players and duels in the middle, and they go really tight, really aggressive, and it leaves the back line exposed as well. Where again, you've got a lot of 1v1 matchups. You do have two centre backs on the number nine, but I think that what happened was that as Liverpool got the first goal, and they could sit a little bit deeper, that pulls the Manchester United players away from their own half. It allows you to expose that back line a little bit more. And when you're reliant on those 1v1 matchups always coming off, when you're in a position where the pressure is ramped up, it becomes harder to get those right all the time. And so that's why Manchester United fell apart, because those 1v1 matchups suddenly just stopped happening, because there's a psychological element to it as much as a physical one.
I think I see this quite a lot in five-a-side playing, like a very, very terrible level. But if people are marking man-to-man, and one person, like say someone goes up front and they just want to stand up front, and then their defender brings it out, suddenly they have a massive advantage, because someone has to go to then close down that one player who's got the ball going through the middle of the pitch, because you should be in a diamond shape, really. And then someone else goes to that, then leaves someone else free, and it's dominoes. So then when you see players like Fernandes, who will do something stupid, like when he's going down holding his face because he's pretending to be injured or whatever, because he wants to get, I don't know what he wants to gain from it.
To be fair,
he gets a little knock to the chin, not enough.
I'm not defending him at all, but I felt a little bit bad for him in that specific instance, because Gary Neville, who was clearly really annoyed, watched the first replay where it appeared that Fernandes wasn't touched in his face, and then said, look, it's a chest. You watch the second one. He just continues saying the same thing. You can clearly see his face.
A bit of a chin. But
that's a normal thing that all footballers do. Fernandes just has a bit of proclivity for the dramatics around it.
This is the thing. He likes the drama of it. Yeah. Like, he definitely tries to...
And he's at the centre of attention, so the conversation centres around him a lot. But I think he gets a bit of an unfair rap for those sorts of things.
No, I think it's entirely fair. I think he does it all the time, and he does it at times when you don't need to do it. And he reminds me of players.
I think he's not very good at doing it.
Maybe that's what it is. It just annoys me that you do it not at all, because I can understand when you want to gain an advantage sometimes and it's part of the game, but he does it when there's just no need to do it, and then he moans about things and he starts going out with the referee.
What's interesting, to take the side of people listening who might be biased, Andy Robertson did exactly the same thing in this game, where he got touched in the chest and he went down grabbing his face for a long time, and nobody mentioned it. No commentator mentioned it at all.
He doesn't have a
reputation for doing it all the time. But I think sometimes it gets pulled out of context. Sometimes it gets made.
Yeah, sure. I can understand what you're trying to say. I get it. That's one example of Fernandes doing that. But my point is not to go and hammer on with Fernandes for pretending to be injured.
He screws the beginning of the system, right?
Exactly, yeah. So then when you're doing that, then you're not in place, which means someone else is free. And if you're man-to-man, that's a real problem. And Man United have exploited that really well against teams who do it, Bielsa's Leeds. Mm-hmm. They've done them a few times, especially McTominay being really good at just driving past someone.
Yeah.
And that's quite useful when you can take advantage of it. But then that psychological meltdown that they seem to have where... Then, because that person's not doing it, that person won't do it, and then that person won't do it, and then you start falling apart. And it looks like there's a division between attack and defence, and there's no middle.
Yeah.
And so then Fred goes to try and do extra stuff, but he can't do it, and they get pulled apart.
Well, listen, I'm sure we're going to talk about Manchester United a lot more in this regard. It'd be very interesting to see how they bounce back. I'm not sure who their next game is against.
They're playing Southampton, I think. Real Sociedad on Thursday.
Real Sociedad Thursday, Southampton on the weekend.
Real Betis.
So the interesting game. That's quite a big fixture to bounce back in. We'll see what they do. Ten Hag, I think, fairly making the point afterwards that this is not the same as a bad loss. This is a different thing he hasn't seen from his players before. But from Liverpool's
Just following on from what JJ was saying about Leeds playing a man-for-man system. And
just ignoring all the things I said about us moving on.
Let's just say what it is, though, right?
You are ignoring everything I just said, and you're going to say what you wanted to say anyway.
Yeah, I'm just going to say that I think the Bielsa link is quite nice, because I think we saw a lot of games when Bielsa was the manager of Leeds where, you know, we were very competent against teams around us in the table, but then we would come up against a team like Manchester United who were able to pull our man marking around, and we got absolutely turned over.
You get pumped 5-0.
And a lot of people point to the expected goals and they say, oh, it's only 3 expected goals. It just felt like everything came off for the opposition. That literally happened in every game where Leeds got absolutely pumped.
It's game state. We love game state here at TIFO Football Podcast.
One, if you're losing these situations where you're just opened out and the opposition are able to generate really good chances, you don't need a huge amount of chances to score goals. No. The other thing is when you're 3 or 4 nil up as a Premier League footballer, there's no pressure on your shot whatsoever. So those shots become a lot easier to make as well. So I think that comes into it too.
Game state. Speaking of game state, why don't Liverpool play every game like this one? Because they were good in this one and they haven't been as good as they were in this one in other games this season.
I think that the way that Manchester United played was maybe a bit naive for this kind of game. And we've already said that they played this really aggressive out-of-possession system. If you watch the game back, there's phases of play in the first half where the three Manchester United midfielders are all pushed up against their Liverpool counterparts because they're playing player for player. And it just leaves space open for Liverpool to exploit. So it's almost making Liverpool's job a little bit easier.
It is, but haven't we seen Liverpool so far this season? You know, we described it before as in some cases becoming 10 1v1 duels, you know, or 9. Those are the examples of the sorts of things that we've seen Liverpool not perform superbly at throughout this season so far, right? Individual errors and
issues. Yeah, but I think the issue there is that what they're doing here is they're in the attacking phase when those duels are taking place. I don't think that Manchester United really made Liverpool's press get exposed at any point in a way that other teams have done. And so it just very much became a case of Liverpool tried to play through the Man United press. If they can do that, they then have a lot of space to then exploit. And they've got Nunez on one side and Salah on the other, and they can get those players running in behind. And I think that's just perfect for them.
And Liverpool have been handed the ball a lot as well. It's not that they're winning it back with the press. It was they were in position to press, but they were being given the ball. And that one of the goals is a counterattack from like a corner, I think it was, back to front. And
I felt like they just had to sit deep and then wait for those spaces to open up, play a few passes. They knew that they had the fullback open, so there's a nice get out for an aggressive press. Play that pass and then see what happens from there.
Yeah. There's a psychological point to it as well with Liverpool in that they've definitely been really good against big teams this season, apart from Real Madrid, obviously, in Champions League. But in the Premier League, they've been really good against City. They did not beat City, I think, didn't they?
Yeah, early on in the season.
And they just... Not that they raise the level, but this happens sometimes. And we think they're at the beginning of a new cycle. They're trying to transition into what they're going to be. They're having not the greatest time. They're still close to the Champions League. They could easily get into that.
It's worth saying. Yeah. They're currently 3 points off the top four with various different states of games in hand. So it's a bit complicated to work out. But something else, which I think may be important to mention, two players, certainly throughout the first half and the beginning of the second half, that were maybe most instrumental to them, Darwin Nunez and Cody Gakpo, two new players. It felt like I was watching a Liverpool team for the first time where that front three kind of clicked together.
Klopp's tried a few different bits and pieces. He couldn't do it before Gakpo was there, obviously. And Firmino's going to leave it into the season. So it's interesting to see whether he wants to go with the same kind of falsy nine situation where the number nine drops in to help link with the midfield and have some dialogue there. But they can rotate with Nunez, who can also go through to the left or through the middle. So that's one thing. That'll take time to come through. Like, I agree with Gary Neville saying this is like a freak result. But Liverpool were good for it. They were great. They played the way they should have been playing and everything kind of worked for them. And that gives you momentum and confidence. And my point on the psychological aspect of it is maybe they're really, really up for the big games and they've got the crowd behind them and then just everyone goes at it 100% mentality monster style going at it. But when you play against a team you've played a load of times in the last few years and maybe you're just not quite on it that one game, that's when you drop that little bit of intensity when you're that Liverpool team, then that's when the little gaps come in and you see the little bits of defence exposure that have been letting them concede goals during the season, if that makes sense.
It does.
But not to say that they're not desperate to win every single game, but there will be certain ones where you're more up. It just is. And then when that happens, this could be one of those things that then gives them that revive. Oh, this is how good we could be. This is what we need to be. And then it's a real, it's like a, it galvanizes them maybe going forward, even though they're already half decent.
There's, look forward to them losing their next game.
Well, exactly. This, that's exactly what I was going to, I was thinking, was watching this weirdly. I was thinking, I bet they're nowhere near as good in that next game.
Who do they play next, Liverpool? Do we know?
There's a lack of consistency with Liverpool this season, right? That's
Bournemouth.
I know,
and they beat them 9-0, didn't they, at the beginning of the season?
They'll beat them.
But I do think a lot of this comes down to a lack of consistency. You know, the Premier League's weird at the moment because the race for number four spot in that last Champions League spot just seems so open because all of the teams in it seem desperate to not win. So Spurs drop points at the weekend. Newcastle are dropping away. And Liverpool, as we've said, incredibly still in with a chance of getting the top four, despite the fact that we've been talking about them uniquely having a uniquely terrible season. I mean, last week on the podcast, I said I just don't understand how Liverpool can have just got so bad so quickly.
And that's what fired them up.
That's right. But it'll be fascinating to see how that race for the number four spot goes.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, another dramatic fixture that occurred over the weekend that probably would have led our coverage today had Liverpool not smashed Man United 7-0 was Arsenal's comeback. Arsenal 3 to AFC Bournemouth, team we were just discussing. Bournemouth, pretty good in this game there, JJ Bull. But I suppose a description that has been attached or has attached itself to this game is that of a title-winning sort of result for Arsenal. I mean, they scored their third goal in 90 minutes plus 7.
And they were down within 9 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, great. It shows great resilience and team camaraderie to be able to come back.
Give you another idiom. Can I add to John's idiom list?
Spirit.
That comes later. The idiom great list spirit. Comes later. We're recording this backwards, by the way, so it's possible that there are references.
It's
that
happening
are yet
now,
to happen.
Continuity and in the past, and in the future, all one
That's
moment.
That's right, yeah.
Back to how time works.
Yeah.
A couple of changes that Arteta made for this game. So you had Trossard playing up front.
Big Tross.
Yeah. He got injured quite early on, didn't he?
He did,
in the 22nd minute.
With Fabio Vieira starting instead of Xhaka, who started every single game so far in the season. That's not why they conceded the goal early on. But it was a routine from kickoff. Why doesn't everyone do that, like a routine? It's so because you've got a clear...
Well, they do, don't they? They usually score from them.
Yeah.
I've seen them
well,
do that a lot.
More people should score from them.
More people should score. I agree with that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
Good corner. Apparently that routine they already did another time, didn't they? You were saying, John?
The goal kick.
No, was it a corner?
The corner where a blocker drags in the near post marker away.
The Bournemouth set piece goal, yeah.
Set pieces are often rehearsed because they are repeatable actions. So it's good for you to make sure you've got some kind of plan with them.
And that one, like the way they score is the player who scores it attacks the near post zone and they just have a blocker who drags the near post blocker away.
Very
so it's
simple.
Free. It's very simple, yeah.
I was listening to a Spurs podcast this morning. What's it called? The Extra Inch. That's a good show. And they were talking about a set piece routine that they have done, which Harry Kane keeps scoring from. They described it as like it's the set piece that just keeps on giving. No one's doing anything to stop it. They just keep scoring. Very fun.
I was going to say Bournemouth generated 0.3 xG according to Opta from 4 chances at 4 shots. So
is that a lot or not?
I think that's a lot. Yeah, because I mean, I guess if you divide them.
Because it's meaningless when you just say it. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, so 1.3 XG is like over a goal's worth of expected goals, which you would expect to probably score from.
Yeah.
To do that with 4 shots is pretty incredible because that means that on average you're generating 0.3.
Just to be clear, you said 1.3.
1.3.
Because I think initially you said 0.3.
Oh, sorry.
Which was why it confused me.
They generated 1.3. XG from 4 chances, which is on average 0.03.
And that's
which
a lot, is it?
You'd call that a big chance, so 4 big chances.
Yeah.
So there's definitely something.
Oh, the Sabre Ramsdale, the 1-on-1, is so good.
Yeah. So they generated, like, obviously the way that they're playing the game is sit deep, try and hit on the break.
They had 19% possession.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so it's another weird game, right? We talked about this with the Aston Villa game, right? Where they deserved to win that game, but they won it in extra time. And this was another game which they deserved to win, but the manner in which they win it is sort of like, well, they also kind of deserve to drop points as well. But this was very much about one of the ways of causing Arsenal problems is by just refusing them any space. They're really good at generating space in behind the opposition's defensive midfielders, attacking that space and generating chances from there. One way you can stop doing that is by sitting really deep. You don't allow any of that space to open up, but you give the opposition the ball through the whole game. So Arsenal dominated pretty much the ball the whole game. Bournemouth were able to take advantages of a few forays into the opposition half. It's a risky way of playing because you're giving the opposition the ball and saying,
and
come
like
at us.
And you say, every time they did have a chance, it was quite a big one.
So there's two things to say. One is that when you play like that against Arsenal, even if you play really well and do exactly what you set out to do, they are still more likely to beat you in those situations. But the other one is that there's definitely a way of causing Arsenal problems by sitting deep and then trying to hit them on the break.
Okay.
So I think that's what we'll start seeing more of as the season goes
on. That's what teams do against Rangers and Celtic in Scotland.
You'd be careful now. I mean, again, the reference won't make sense yet because it hasn't happened. You'll hear it in the second half. But there is a reason why JJ needs to be careful about what he says. Yeah. Far be it from me to allow you to have another shocking experience such as the one that the listener will discover in the second half. Okay, we're going to a break before the West Ham bit.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Tony Evans here, host of Walk On, the Athletic's new look Liverpool podcast. 7-0. Seven. Count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's what Jürgen's boys can do. And to Manchester United, is that the game to ignite the Reds' running? Well, we hope so. Join myself, James Pearce, Kiefer O'Neill and Andy Jones as we get stuck into Liverpool sticking it to United. Mo Salah's record-breaking afternoon, as well as bringing you the best post-match analysis around. Just search Walk On wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yes, that was a break. One quick last thing on Arsenal after the break. Very confusing, isn't it? This is good, though. Harvey Downs on Twitter tweeted this. Arsenal have named a starting 11 without a single player to have made a competitive appearance under Arsene Wenger for the first time since January 1986.
Is that because Xhaka didn't play? Is that?
It's because Xhaka didn't start, yeah. And then I was thinking, I guess the only other team that that's kind of attributable to is Manchester United. And De Gea is still starting. It may have already happened. De Gea may have missed a game. I don't know if it's happened or not. But that gap gone be long is all I'll say.
One last thing from that Arsenal game. The noise that you hear from the Emirates when Nelson scores the winner and then the noise at full time is so good. Like, it's one of those, I love those noises. And there's a couple of examples.
Are you bringing that up because of that time we got in trouble for talking about noise at the Emirates?
They pump it into the stadium.
That's not what I
That's
said.
That's what you said, Joe.
Hey, fuck you, man. I didn't say that.
We don't read the comments, you know. But there's a few sounds in football. Like, one of the best things about football is the noise when those big games happen, the big like goals happen, and everyone goes nuts. I absolutely love it. There's one when the second time that Liverpool beat Newcastle 4-3, and Fowler scores this goal at the back post. The noise, I swear, the note is just slightly higher than it would normally be. It's rather than like it's just slightly higher, and everyone's screaming it. And you saw it here against Bournemouth at the very end. Just that extra bit, it meant so much to everyone. They were so invested because what an amazing story. The way they've you absolutely could script that because that would be the best way to make a game is if you concede early and then you score in the very last seconds. It's great.
Yes.
Another good one was when Adam Rooney, who plays for Aberdeen, he scored the winning penalty in the League Cup final and the
Rooney!
Noise. Exactly. He scored, but I watched the video now and again because the noise in the crowd is just slightly different to what it normally is when Aberdeen score a goal. Like, I know what that noise is, what that tone, what the note is. But
have I said? Did I tell you when I went? Was it earlier this season or last season? I went to see the women's North London derby. Did I tell you about this?
No.
I went with my sister Alice, who's a big football fan, and a couple of our family members. We were watching it, and obviously the crowd, there were many more women in the crowd than you would find at a men's Premier League game, and also there were I think many more families, many more children,
yeah,
there
definitely.
Too. So the sound of the boo when the Arsenal fans were booing Tottenham, it was higher. It was different. It was unusual. It was like, I don't know, I have the same experience as you. Like, that pitch and tone is like embedded in me from hearing it every week. And then when it's just like upper
people
semi-octave
booing you.
Or something. Yeah, people booing me. When it's upper semi-octave, you're like, oh yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and you just notice it. I don't know, there's something very melodic and musical-like about it. You know, often people sing the songs, they do it in a voice like, Aberdeen, and they wouldn't talk like that
Aberdeen,
normally.
Aberdeen, Aberdeen. That's one of the Aberdeen songs,
exactly,
isn't it?
But that's when they go, Arsenal, that, rather than doing like, Arsenal.
It's hard to do football voice without, like, but I you know find myself wanting to do that if the only time I ever sing a song in a football game is if I accompany Uncle Damien to Carrow Road and they sing On the Ball City. I don't know all the words, but I pretend to because I feel bad that I'm there if I don't know the words that everyone does. So I go On the Ball City. I find myself doing the football voice.
It's because you want to fit into the everyone. Also, because you can sing.
On the Ball City.
Well, because you can sing.
Never
you do it
mind
differently.
The danger.
Yeah. You know. I was thinking you'd probably like a football chant if it starts with a piano going.
I like the Sheffield Wednesday. Is it Sheffield Wednesday? They sing Hi Ho Silver Lining. And they sing, it's hi ho, and then they turn off the song, and it's like Sheffield Wednesday, and then it carries on with the music. I quite like that. Yeah, so you're singing along to a song, and then it's just like in the middle, and then it's like
I like
normal.
It. Very strange, isn't it?
Very tribal.
Ah, human beings. Anyway, we're here to discuss human beings, and let's do so. A quick meander through the results. I know we haven't got much time to spare, Steve Hankey. I know. But a couple of things, of course, we referenced.
Let them eat cake, Joe.
Let them eat cake. Another reference. That will make sense when you listen to the second half. Man City, of course, passing Newcastle, not untroubled, difficult game. Newcastle created lots of opportunities, didn't score. Another team that created lots of opportunities and didn't score, Leicester. That was weird, wasn't it? Oh, good lord.
You missed like eight goals.
Poor boy. Yeah.
He's
anyway.
A good player, though.
Here's another little note I took, John. This is for you, of course. Javi Gracia is the new Leeds manager. Javi Gracia looks like a musical comedian Boothby Grafoe and Pyat Pree from Game of Thrones had a baby and taught it to be a football manager.
That's a very niche reference.
I did think that as I wrote it down, but it's fine. Anyway, fine. Let's also discuss another big fixture from the weekend, or perhaps not the fixture, but the state of the team at the moment. Brighton 4. 0 West Ham. Now, Guten Tag, that's bad for West Ham because, of course, not only is it a 4-0 loss away at the Amex, it is West Ham have only gained 6 points away from home this season so far. They are 100% in a relegation battle, 23 points, just one off Everton, who are an uptick of form in 18th place. It's troubling times for David Moyes, isn't it? Although Roisin, who is the Athletic's West Ham correspondent, did say, Roisin Thomas wrote, Moyes still retains the full support of the board. But this, of course, was perhaps the day that he lost the faith of the fans.
The fans have been very patient with him, haven't they, I feel? I feel as though he's had a weird trajectory at West Ham because he's had two stints there and he's sort of... Obviously, the second stint was characterised by him saving them from relegation. And then it sort of coincided with pandemic football. And I think that suited them to a degree because they play sort of fairly solid, not particularly energetic football, quite direct football in possession. And that worked out for them. And now once that period was over, they then dropped a little bit again. They're another team who are like weird underlying numbers phenomenon freaks because their underlying numbers put them much closer to the mid table than the bottom of the table. But the big story for me with Moyes is that he was almost tasked with taking them from being a team who were a relegation battler to a team who got into Europe for a little while. Yeah. And it felt as though they needed to make a play style shift to being a team who could maybe manage games a little bit more. They couldn't just be that direct, sit deep, hit teams on the break kind of team. And they haven't made that step. And it's not looking great at all. So.
They've got a top quality squad, though, haven't they? I mean, it's sort of, when you look at some of the other teams that surround them, I suppose you wouldn't include Everton in that, just because Everton also have a very good squad. But in comparison to Bournemouth and Southampton, and an argument to be made for Leeds, West Ham have a much higher quality squad of individual players overall.
I think they have a decent team that could realistically expect to finish in the top half of the table, which is what the fans want them to do.
Yes.
When you look at Moyes at Everton, he would finish one season, he would finish maybe like 11th or 7th or something like that. And then there's a couple of seasons early on at Everton where they finished high up, but then the season after they went really low, like 17th, 16th.
They sort of cycled up and then big down and then cycled up. Yeah,
he had a couple of those
down.
In a row. And then after that, he stabilised them and then they kept growing.
Yeah.
But like John says, the underlying numbers, that they just, they're missing all their chances.
Yeah.
Specifically, like one of the huge drop-offs for me this season is Jarrod Bowen, who was massively important to them last season.
Yeah.
And when they play in the counter, he's amazing. Him, Antonio, like they're just really good at playing on the counter-attack, exploiting space in behind. They could do it because he sat deep to avoid being... They want to be hard to beat, David Moyes' teams, as you want to do.
Mm.
Lots of wide-focused possession play, lots of crosses, inverted wingers, but he's playing with a front three normally with the central striker and two inside forwards, I guess you call them, maybe inverted wingers, doesn't really matter. But Jarrod Bowen is about 3.37 expected goals underneath what he should be, him specifically.
Thomas Soucek isn't scoring goals. He moved to Liverpool, didn't he, Jarrod Bowen? It sounded like that was going to happen and then it didn't happen. And
yeah, it could be various reasons. He's just not been on it this season. But if you're missing one of your key players from the season before, that's a real big thing, even though it's only just a few goals.
Yeah.
But those can separate the 1-0s and the 0-0s from what you've been losing. Then, because they're not scoring, they're more susceptible to conceding and being vulnerable in that way.
What's happening with Scamacca? I haven't noticed him much this season.
He's been injured. He's played 16 games. Well, he's at 16 appearances anyway. He's actually one of the only players shooting over his expected goals.
Right, really?
Very barely. I mean, his expected goals are 2.47. His goals are 3.
Yeah.
So it's not perfect. But this is the thing with Moyes, is that his Everton teams were never particularly exciting, but they were hard to break down and they would grind games out and get it's not hugely exciting.
Well,
but,
and you had Stephen Pienaar, Leighton Baines, and Seamus Coleman.
West Ham has got better as well. I think it's worth saying. Two things have happened. One is that the talent the bottom of the table teams have is much higher naturally. And the other thing is, because it's so financially viable to stay in the Premier League, you get teams at the bottom now just bedding in and just wanting to take draws against teams around them because, you know, that can be enough to keep you up. And I think both of those things have probably made the West or the David Moyes play style a little bit more harder to get an advantage from as well. If teams are just sitting deep, then it's going to be much harder to be able to directly attack them.
I'd love to hear what you have to say, but we've got to end the show.
Oh, do we?
I mean, is it going to take 10 seconds?
Yeah, I can do really quickly. Okay. Rafa Benitez said a very interesting thing in the Newcastle Man City thing, where how come if you spend loads of money like West Ham did, it doesn't necessarily make you better because everyone else is also spending money. And when you spend that money, you've got to be successful as it works.
10.
Otherwise, you run out of time to be able to do it.
That was 11. I tell you what, I didn't listen to anything you said, but I'm proud of you.
It was counting in your head, seconds, weren't you?
Yeah. I was counting with my mouth.
I think I got it. I think I nailed it.
Well done. Well
your
done
mouth
you.
Is actually part of your head as well.
Right. Well, listen, let's have a break now. And then when we come back, you will hear us discussing things that we discussed over an hour ago.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic. The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Oh, what a lovely break that was. We've returned from a delightful break. Anyway, before we get started with the second section, first let me reintroduce Mr. Seb Staffelblor. Ah, guten Tag, Herr Staffelblor.
Guten Nachmittag, Herr Devine. Wie geht's?
Yes, V. Gates are sehr good. Listen, but we're going to talk to Seb in the second half about various things on the continent and beyond. Well, not beyond the continent, but beyond the concept of geographical borders. But before we do that, and speaking of geographical borders, there was a little complaint about a show that we recorded. When was it? Was it last week?
It was last week, yeah.
And JJ, I'm just going to read to you what someone sent. Not to me, not to you, but to our editor here at The Athletic. He kindly forwarded it on to me. I won't reveal the name of this person. We shan't dox anybody. But I thought it would be nice fun for you to hear this, and also for our listeners to hear what, on occasion, the kinds of bullshit we have to deal with. Yeah? Hi, Alex. Alex is the name of our editor. Long-time subscriber and fan here. Thank you for the great content. As such, I was hugely surprised and disappointed by JJ Bull's performance on the TIFO podcast this week. As an exiled Scotsman in the south of England, I was excited to read that Celtic and Rangers were getting the headline treatment on the podcast. Not really true. It was a second headline. But instead of any kind of analysis, says this person, JJ, on Sunday's game, we got the following. A. JJ responding to a good question about Ange Postecoglou's tactical setup and fit with the Premier League jobs, with JJ repeating tired tropes about money in the Scottish game. Very tired those tropes were. A question about the relative strength of both Rangers and Celtic squads, players to watch, where they might go in the Premier League, JJ, answered by JJ with a weird ramble about Aberdeen players who've left recently. It goes on for some time. But I'll come back to say, it generally strikes me as odd that you, and of course this again is addressed to our editor, that you would continue to employ someone who seems intent on dragging down Scottish football rather than talking it up when given the opportunity to do so, as is your duty. You must talk up Scottish football, JJ Bull. Beyond the tone, you appear unable to be analytical or objective in the way that this person has come to expect from all of the other people that work here. I hope you will consider his position for the upcoming season, as our game has never been in better health and subscribers to The Athletic deserve so much better. Now, whilst I agree that Athletic subscribers deserve the very best, I did think it was worth reading that out just to let the more casual and calm listener at home know that sometimes people do write to our bosses to ask for us to be fired. And it's quite weird when you say it out loud like that.
Yeah.
But do you have anything to say to this person who said that?
Well, the problem with you reading that out is that I have a mandate, which is to bring down the Scottish game from within London, which is why I first moved down here.
That's why you left Scotland in the first place.
So it's problematic that you've brought it up, because that's all I want to do is bring it down.
I agree.
Burn it down. End it.
Yeah, end it. Yeah.
And I've tried, but they just keep going.
They do, don't they?
Yeah.
They're very enduring.
Another thing is, all those clubs are very, very equally balanced in terms of wealth.
Mm.
So, I mean, obviously what I'm saying is silly. I mean, just because one earns slightly more than the other doesn't mean that they shouldn't be able to compete at the same level, always.
Do you agree that you should lose your job?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, that's in fact. And I'm not really here being paid. I've done what like Larry David did in real life and just turned up for work on the Monday.
Seb, has anyone ever written to your boss to ask for you to be sacked?
I mean, technically that's you, so maybe we could have an ad-lib version.
I write to myself about that sometimes.
I mean, you could, yes. Yeah, with two puppets asking, debating whether I should still be employed.
I've written to Joe Lowe's trying to get you sacked, Seb.
I know, but it kind of descends into a kind of incoherent ramble about Scottish football every time. So the points just don't land.
Because you keep trying to bring it up. Yeah.
People sometimes, to me, they will at, when they're responding to something on Twitter or they're tweeting me on Twitter, they'll also include the handle of the company I work for, as if they think when the company sees what I've said, there'll be serious consequences. You know,
people do that. They tag in big companies thinking they that do. It's not like a 22-year-old intern doing the socials that day.
Anyway, if you're at home listening to this or indeed watching this on YouTube and you're thinking, maybe I'll write to someone's boss and try and get them sacked, don't do that because it's weird. It's a very strange thing. Also, when it's written like this in a very polite, collegiate way, but the undertone is insidious. Anyway, thank you for sending that in and all the best to you with your future. Now, Seb has joined us, of course, to discuss all sorts of interesting things. And Seb Stafford-Blaw, we're going to start with the sort of tricky topic of Newcastle United and their ownership. Because something happened in golf, correct me if I'm wrong, the first time anything's ever happened in golf, which was important. What was that, Seb?
So, for those who don't follow golf, it has been probably the most controversial period in its history because there is a big legal fight between the PGA Tour, which has sort of run the world's main golfing tour for eternity, and LIV Golf, which is run by the Public Investment Fund, who own 80% of Newcastle. And over the past couple of years, or over the past year even, they've sort of snatched away some of the biggest personalities and players in golf to compete in a new tournament. And there have been all kinds of arguments about whether these players can take part in old PGA Tour competitions. And obviously there's a lot of acrimony between different players and people within the sport. However, where this affects Newcastle is the fact that this little fight, well, part of this fight has ended up in court in America. And it's resulted in Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who is he's the chairman of Newcastle, but also the governor of the Public Investment Fund. He's been subpoenaed and there have been a request for documents from the PIF. And the lawyers acting on their behalf have tried to claim a degree of immunity on their behalf, saying that Al-Rumayyan is a quote, sitting minister of the Saudi government. And there's a slightly longer bit, which is worth reading here, which discusses the kind of the claim for documents specifically. And it says, this is from the lawyers, the order is an extraordinary infringement on the sovereignty of a foreign state that is far from justified here. The PIF and His Excellency Yasser Al-Rumayyan are not ordinary third parties subject to basic discovery relevant standards. So this is tricky for the Premier League and for Newcastle because, as we all remember, when that deal was waved through by the Premier League, Richard Masters said that he'd received legally binding assurances from PIF, which assured him that they were not acting on behalf of the Saudi state, that Newcastle weren't essentially being operated by Saudi Arabia, by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. He also said that the Premier League retained the, not quite sure of what the terminology should be, but some kind of legal mechanism to remove PIF if these legally binding assurances were broken or contradicted. So naturally, quite a few Premier League clubs, kind of unsure of which ones, but quite a few Premier League clubs are unhappy about this and are kind of exerting some kind of pressure on the Premier League to act. Amnesty International have also asked the Premier League to clarify their position and to investigate further. It's worth saying, just in the interest of fairness, Amanda Staveley was questioned about this. She's been taking part in some kind of summit over the past week. And she said that, quote, the undertaking was that Saudi Arabia would not control the club, full stop. That undertaking has been and is being honoured. So clearly she disputes that. But a really, really tricky position for the Premier League and obviously Richard Masters, given that he was the one to give all of those assurances when the takeover went through.
Yeah, we have the quote from Richard Masters in telling the BBC in November 2021 that if the organisation found evidence that the state was involved in the running of Newcastle, quote, we can remove the consortium as owners of the club. It sort of feels like it would be a big surprise, even though it seems kind of obvious, if that happened, Seb. Not expecting that to happen.
Yeah, a big surprise because it would be completely unprecedented. Even if forgetting the Premier League, if you look at sort of English football's history and its recent past with owners, it's an extraordinary step for someone to actually be removed. It's really something really you associate with American sport, for instance, and you know the ability to kind of take a franchise away from somebody if they've done something awful or if they're not fit to run it. we've never really had a situation where a potential owner has provided these legally binding insurances and has had to do so because of this specific fear, even. So how that would work and how that would work with the inevitable legal challenge that would follow, I have absolutely no idea. And I haven't actually, so recording this on a Monday, and I haven't actually seen any proper response from the Premier League. But then I suppose this is involved in all kinds of other issues at the moment, including, you know, the charges against Manchester City and the legal fight that's obviously going to go on there. Also, and I know we'll talk about this at some other point, but the publishing of the government white paper and the Premier League's, it's not too subtle, attempt to show that it doesn't need regulation of any sort and it's completely capable of regulating itself. So you have all these kind of conflicting issues and sort of converging winds, and Newcastle and the PIF is just another thing to add to that mix, really. It's goodness knows what happens from here.
It is kind of funny though, isn't it? Because it seems as though, to sort of maybe inaccurately, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, Seb, but to summarise what Seb is saying, that on the one hand, the PIF have argued that they are totally separate for opportune reasons. And on the other hand, they've argued that they are not separate at all for opportune reasons. It's weird, John, that we kind of live in a world where, even though we know this, nothing's probably going to happen. I mean, how does that work?
It's definitely a case of having their cake and eating it here, right? Mm. They want to get the advantages of claiming that there's no relation when it suits them, and then they want to have the advantage of claiming there is a relation between the PIF and the Saudi government when it does suit them. So,
and who wouldn't want cake and to eat it?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. Although I believe that that idiom is actually talking about having cake there and eating it. If you eat it, it's not there anymore.
It's not there
right?
anymore. So, yeah.
The commonly misunderstood
idiom.
Then they apply why else would you get cake?
Was that Marie Antoinette who came up with that? Was it Marie Antoinette?
No, she said, let them eat cake.
Let them eat cake.
That was when there was no bread for the French peasants. So she said, let them eat cake.
Let them eat cake.
Because obviously
there
cake
is cake.
Yeah. They had cake, so they could...
Eat the cake.
They didn't, but they could have had cake, so...
Because that other saying that implies that why else would you buy a cake if not, like, you buy them to eat them, don't you? Mm-hmm. So like when you buy DVDs and don't watch them and collect them, you don't collect cakes, do you? So of course you would eat it.
I have collected cakes, but I have collected them specifically around my midriff. Anyway, speaking of collecting cakes, Bayern Munich, Seb Stavroblor, attempting to collect... Oh, isn't an 11th cake in a row in the form of the Bundesliga title? But I touch wood so that nothing changes, you know, for fear of sort of disturbing the natural order of things, Seb. But could there be a delectable Bundesliga title challenge? I dare you to say no.
No, there is. I don't think we'll be. I think we've got to the first week of March. Borussia Dortmund are level on points with Bayern Munich. And... this is not the Bayern Munich of old. This is not the steamroller Munich. There's a vulnerability to them. There's obviously their continued participation in the Champions League is not a distraction, but it's something else that they have to shoulder. And they don't have some of the luxuries of previous years. So obviously, Lewandowski is the obvious one. They don't have that, the kind of the tonnage of goals that he used to provide. But also there's a little bit of shakiness at the back. I mean, it's not sort of been quite as discussed as Lewandowski. I think they really miss David Alaba and... not just the battery of skills that he provides, but also the understanding of how to win. Alaba is a, you know, look at his mantelpiece. He's got one of the sort of most enviable collections of trophies in modern European footballing history. And at the same time, there are kind of, there's a lot of noise around Bayern Munich. There's noise around Nagelsmann's future. There was a big old fallout as a result of an interview that our own Rafa Honigstein did with Manuel Neuer and how upset he was at the club's decision to sack their goalkeeping coach, who's also actually Manuel Neuer's best man at his wedding. So there's turbulence, and Borussia Dortmund, and I hope this doesn't sound mean-spirited, but without being particularly outstanding, they've been consistent. They've benefited from some good performances in key areas, some excellent goalkeeping. They've extracted a lot of value over Jude Bellingham's growth as a player and transformation to a generally world-class midfielder. And they're playing well.
Well, I mean, they're on an incredible run, aren't they? Like, I mean, JJ, obviously they beat Leipzig 2-1 over the weekend. That's a massive result for them. But I don't think I'm wrong in saying they haven't lost since the World Cup.
They've won 11 games in a row now.
They've won 11 games in a row?
Yeah, when they beat Leipzig on Friday, yeah.
That is nuts.
It's good. They also beat Chelsea in the Champions League, which is a big result.
Sure.
Great goal, that, by the way. They scored against them. And they play them on Tuesday when this podcast comes out.
Right.
So we'll see how they get on with it. They're missing some big players for that game.
Yes, okay.
They're decent. But then another thing, the underlying numbers, so without wanting to rain on the parade of the Bundesliga, like Bayern, from the outside, I don't pay enough attention to the Bundesliga properly. I'm looking to kind of watch a video on Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah.
But if you look at underlying numbers, expected points is one measure of it. Like Bayern are basically where they should be. They're top because they have the most expected points. And you look at Borussia, it's for 49.4 and they're on 49 points, for example. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and this doesn't matter because you can look at different leagues and I can give you some examples around Europe as well. Borussia Dortmund are on 30, no, they're on 49 points, equal with Bayern. They were top of the league for a little bit on Friday, but their expected points is 37. Mm. So it's quite an overperformance. And Union Berlin are similar, 31.5 expected points, actually 44. It's big overperformances.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can keep those up for the rest of the season. And if they do, then you've got a title race. But
One would suggest that an argument you could make would be that an overperformance would be required from any team.
Well, exactly. And an underperformance from Bayern. That's how you would do it. Yeah. So if Bayern do then not pick up and don't perform at what level they should do, and that's where you get the title race. But then you look around, I mean, in the Premier League, this is the thing as well. Like Arsenal look good for the title. They could easily win it. And they're massively overperforming expected points.
Mm.
They're 51.6 expected, actual 63. Yeah. So underlying numbers over a whole season would suggest that this is not sustainable, but again, that's why football's quite good. And sometimes you get random winners. So maybe there is a title race.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Also,
well, Union Berlin, speaking of, drew to Köln over the weekend, John, 0-0. They are still in third place, 44 points now, 5 off the top two. Was this the weekend, do you think, where it became a two-horse race?
We've been saying this all season, that like Union are going to drop off. Their numbers are maybe not as sustainable as they might look. And yeah, I'm with JJ on this. You can talk about underlying numbers till the cows come home, as I like to say. But sample sizes of a season are so small relatively that all you need to do is overperform for, you know, Dortmund have won 11 games in a row. They probably shouldn't have won 11 games in a row, but they have.
Yeah.
And that extra boost of points that they get gives them not only a sort of points bedrock, but also momentum to go into the rest of the season and perform. So whatever, I don't know how many games are left in the rest of the season, but you know, we're getting to the business end of the season now.
Yeah.
They're in a really good position to actually challenge for the title now. Had things happened differently, it wouldn't have been that way. So I do think that the underlying numbers are instructive as to like the level of performances that are being put in. But once you get to this point where you can just push for the last 10, 14 games of a season, then who cares what the underlying numbers say to a degree. So it'll be fascinating to see how the title race plays out. I think with Bayern, with both Bayern and Dortmund, I think what's been really interesting since the World Cup is that they've both sort of gone back to basics a little bit. So in the first half of the season, Bayern were trying a lot of really interesting things tactically. There was a lot of creative thinking from Julian Nagelsmann. He was doing stuff with a concept called minimum width, which is about, actually, we talk a lot about maximum width, right? Keeping your wingers really wide, stretching the back line. Nagelsmann was doing interesting things, having his wingers narrow, being able to get advantages in that way by pinning defences narrower rather than wider. So if you can keep your back line really quite compact, then the space that can be attacked in the wide areas. Arsenal doing interesting stuff with minimum width now. And then Nagelsmann was doing sort of Red Bull stuff, the stuff that we would expect him to have done when he was at Leipzig but didn't, with more direct attacking through the central spaces as well, in line with that minimum width stuff. So that didn't really work out. So now it feels as they've gone back to their sort of standard positional approach that you would expect.
Win games
from,
approach.
Yeah, well, you know, the sort of idea that actually if you structure your team well, you can exploit space. And if you have elite players across the pitch, then you will generally come across quite well. And Dortmund, I think, the same. They've sort of developed this sort of fairly simply structured play style, which is really working for them because it's getting similar to what we've seen with Barcelona, actually, that they've got some really, really good players. They're getting those players into good parts of the field and then relying on moments from those players. But the structure is important because it gives them the bedrock out of which to operate. So they play in this in this sort of, I guess, fairly simple 4-1-4-1 formation. But in possession, Emre Can, who plays as the six, drops in between the two centre-backs. That allows the full-backs to push really high and wide. The midfield four squeeze quite narrow. They were playing Karim Adeyemi as one of the wide players, but he's now pushing forward in possession alongside Allaire. He's now injured, so it will change up a little bit. But then you've got Julian Brandt able to float around a little bit in the central spaces. You've got Jude Bellingham able to cause the problems that we know that he can cause. So for me, like, what Dortmund have done is they've just got a really solid system. They're getting the best out of their players. They have a talent advantage over a lot of teams in the Bundesliga, and that's why they're in the situation that they're in. I guess the difference is that in the big games now, when you would expect them in the first half of the season to maybe drop points, they're now getting those performances where they're actually coming through. But I mean, even against Leipzig, the underlying numbers, Leipzig overproduced expected goals against... I've said that in a really complicated way.
They had a higher expected goals level than Dortmund.
Yeah. And there is a sense in which Dortmund are, I think, going quite heavy out of games and then getting a goal up and then dropping and sitting a little bit deeper. So that invites the opposition on.
Game state,
yeah, is a thing.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Now, listen, Union Berlin, Seb, just to finish on Union Berlin, because, of course, you get to these sorts of stages in a season when a team is maybe challenging and overachieving, and then they start to regress back to perhaps where you would expect them to be. Union Berlin still not doing that. It must be said, it cannot be overstated how incredible it is that they are in the position that they're in, right? And I wanted to point out that you did a really interesting Athletic Football podcast last week with Mark Chapman, where you talked about this very thing.
Yeah, I think one of the things with them, and one of the reasons why possibly underlying numbers is a little bit of a, not fallacy, but why it's a little bit of a distraction in this situation is, if you get the chance to watch Union and you ignore the fact that they defend in a low block, I think one of the things you appreciate is how hard they work without the ball. Their sort of play is kind of predicated on taking away all the kind of central space. So you very, very rarely see an attacking number 10 or playmaker drop in the kind of the central area, the central corridor in front of the penalty box. And that's because you can really see the cogs working. So I went to watch them play Ajax in Amsterdam, and the press box there is very, very high. So you get like your own tactical camera for it. And you can see the sort of the kind of the football manager view of the way they play and how they counter and kind of the efficiencies in their game. And I think what they've been a victim of over the last couple of weeks is number of games, a few distractions. So on Thursday, they play their first leg against Union Saint-Gilloise to potentially progress through to a Europa League quarterfinal, which is absolutely absurd. And the season's progress to this point has been underscored by work ethic, organisation, complete buy-in. Also quite a narrow pool of players. They have chopped and changed a little bit, but they are dependent on a few key pieces. So, for instance, obviously René Kadera, but Yannick Cabrera and Geraldo Becker. Like, without them, Union don't function quite as well, and they're not quite as efficient. So the way they play, I think John touched on this, is to be successful, they've got to be hyper-efficient at the right moment. So chance conversion has got to be absolutely outstanding. Becker's clearly an important part of this. If you look at Herrera's season highlights, you'll see a couple of amazing goals he scored too. So you have all of these perfect moments within it. And without like a little, you know, the occasional touch of luck, but also a game plan executed absolutely perfectly, you see the walls cave in a little bit. So when they played Bayern Munich a couple of weeks ago in Munich, they got absolutely battered, really. And as Fischer said after the game, we weren't even the level below. I think his quote was, we were, you know, two or three levels below, just because the resilience wasn't there physically. You know, they played something like three games in 6 days. They've been to Ajax. They've beaten Ajax back in Copenhagen. I don't think it's really fair to kind of to judge a side like Union on the same basis as some of these other teams. Even someone like Borussia Dortmund, beyond the developments in their game, I think part of their success is about depth. You see kind of the different options they have at fullback, the different wide forward options they have, the development of not just Adeyemi, but I think Daniel Marlin's had a much better season. Jamie Bynoe-Gittens has come back in. Emre Can has had a great season at the base of midfield. But you have other players that can drop back in as well. So I think maybe Marius Wolf, for instance, who can play as a fullback, who can play on the right of midfield if you need him to. At the beginning of the season, not to be too unkind, but he didn't look like he belonged anywhere near the top of the Bundesliga. 6 months later, he's been excellent. He produced the goal which led to the pass which led to Marco Reus's penalty. The kind of this wafted 40-yard outside of the right foot, brilliant, brilliant bit of playmaking, which you'd kind of associate with someone like Kevin De Bruyne. Someone like that is now in the squad. At Union Berlin, you need to be sending out really the same 13, 14 players every week. Otherwise, it's not going to go well just because the resources don't exist. So,
and that's why they call it an Union. But anyway, listen, Seb, we've got 3 minutes and 30 seconds before your Zoom window rudely closes on us. We're not paying for a pro account. How dare you? How dare you, Zoom? Give us a free service that's excellent.
Before I depart, may I make another point just because...
All right, go on then. What are you going to say before you leave?
I was just going to say one of the interesting plot lines is the revival of Schalke this season. And that's interesting because it's the Revier Derby on Saturday night. So Dortmund will go to Schalke, and this is a Schalke team who looked like they were relegated really before the World Cup. They looked absolutely hopeless. And who, under Thomas Reis, who was sacked by Bochum early in the season, have now put together a run of six games without defeat. I think they've only conceded twice. They've been absolutely excellent out of absolutely nowhere. And on Saturday, Reis and Schalke went to Bochum and won. So he went and beat his old employers to put them bottom of the Bundesliga. And so it's a fascinating little kind of nugget from the football gods. You say, right, well, here's your title challenge, Dortmund. And right on time, just at the right moment, here are Schalke in something like the best form they've probably been in about 2 or 3 years, maybe even four, ready to put an axe through their season potentially. So interesting game coming up at the weekend.
Thank you, Seb, for joining us today. And we will chat to you again soon, dear boy. Auf Wiedersehen.
Farewell, dear Joe.
There he goes.
There's a thing where a bit we think there's a title race because we want there to be one.
In the Bundesliga?
Yeah. I mean, the people want there to be one. So it's not just Bayern every single year winning it.
I think there's legitimately a title race, though, isn't there?
I think one. I don't know. I don't think so. I think Bayern will win it.
You're so.
No, as part of my mandate, it's about
as
bringing
part of
down.
My mandate. Oh, I see.
Down the Bundesliga.
I thought it was the Scottish football.
Yeah, it's both.
It's both.
There's many parts. I haven't revealed all of my mandate.
Yeah. My favourite thing from last week, by the way, was we were talking about what we think people find interesting. And I said, oh, I think people are interested in the Bundesliga. And you said, that's like when I say that people are interested in Scottish football and you think it's boring. And I thought, that's not the same. The Bundesliga is not the same as the Scottish Premiership.
But people who like that, they really care about it. I mean,
to people who
Scottish
like
football.
That. But of course, there are how many million people in Germany? 80-something?
6.4.
86.4 million? Steve Hanke's
going to tell us. League where one team always wins it is not amazing.
Yeah. No, I don't think, I'm not arguing.
Like Greek
that the
football
is
something quite interesting because you've got several teams, a few teams who could win it rather than just Olympiacos.
Well, speaking of, that's the reason that we're discussing Serie A. And again, to your jaded sensibility, you don't find this interesting, even though it now riddles and twists your own context. Mm. JJ Bull, the contradict. There he is.
I just say what everyone is the opposite of what everyone else says. Yeah.
Anyway, Serie A, listen, the reason it's exciting, JJ Bull, is because John's going to tell you. We're about to have the fourth different Serie A champion in 4 years, John. That's Napoli, who did lose to Lazio over the weekend, 1-0. That's only their second defeat of the season so far. But they are currently 15 points ahead of Inter Milan in second place. They're doing a terrific job there, John, aren't they? And I'm sure that their team's going to be rifled and picked apart. And then maybe next year there'll be another winner. What do you think?
Yeah, I think a lot of this comes down to the fact that the teams who the leagues that aren't the Premier League are struggling to match the Premier League in terms of the finances. And that does lead to a little bit more of variability in certainly in the Serie A's case. Yeah. It does help that the main team in Italy and Juventus have been riddled with corruption and lost points here, there and everywhere to keep things on the level playing field a little bit as well. But I do think it is a question that needs to be asked whether or not the hyper financialization of football has actually made it less competitive in the long run.
Well, they spent in January, I learned from a Tifo Illustrated script, the whole of Serie A spent 30 million euros, which is less than Bournemouth spent in January.
We've said it a lot on this podcast that teams like AC Milan and Napoli are struggling to compete with teams like Bournemouth in the transfer market as well.
Yeah.
There's a real appetite among players to get into the Premier League by hook or by crook. I never use idioms until I'm on this podcast. I get into the studio.
You love it.
Cows come home.
You were saying earlier the business end of the season.
Yeah, I feel like I'm on the Archers. You know, you stick me in front of a microphone and I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, start making all these weird sound effects, don't you?
But it means you have to look for value in players when, like, you'll find different ones that other players wouldn't take a punt on. Like, Kvaratskhelia is maybe an example where you get him for quite cheap because you don't know how a Georgian international is going to perform in the higher, like, the Premier League. So The difference now with the Premier League teams is that they can buy the ready-made player who comes in and just makes them really good.
Yeah.
Whereas Bournemouth can compete to someone who might be on that level, but they have to pay 30 million for them, whereas Napoli can snap someone up like Kvaratskhelia and do a bit, spend a bit less on them. And then, but then players like Lobotka has been really important to them this season, and you've got like Min-jae Kim's been really, really good. He was very cheap as well. There's value to be had in the transfer market. You don't, just because you spend loads of money on someone doesn't mean they're good.
Yeah,
I think.
But no, I think as well with a team like Napoli, when you have a player like Victor Osimhen, you have a massive advantage over your opponents. And like again, that's not to say that they didn't do great talent acquisition, etc. But when you can bring in a player at that level and it just gives you that advantage over the rest of the teams, it can decide a title as well. But yeah, Napoli have been absolutely brilliant this season, like one of the most exciting teams in Europe. So it's been nice to see them come through. And it's, yeah, like we had AC Milan last season playing a very different brand of football to what Napoli are doing as well. There's definitely that variability there, which makes it a fun league to watch.
And all like, in all, that exciting.
I decided I like it now.
You're into
the
it.
The top four is changing all the time as well. Like we said, we had Juventus in there. Mm. They lost 15 points, dropped out. And then we saw AC Milan drop out again this weekend and were replaced by Roma.
Yeah.
Lazio are doing quite well. Yeah, Atalanta are always there and thereabouts.
So Lazio, 48 points. Lazio could finish second.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Very changeable. And of course, Milan losing to Fiorentina over the weekend as well there. Monza 2, 1 Empoli. I just wanted to say that. What else have we got? Oh, here, Steve's dropped a couple of things in here for us to round up. Population of Germany, 83.2 million as of 2021.
We weren't far off that.
We weren't far off at all. And the etymology of some idioms. For you there, John, some that you've already used. Having your cake and eating it. Of course, you used that one earlier. An early recording of the phrase is in a letter on the 14th of March, 1538, from Thomas, Duke of Norfolk, to Thomas Cromwell as, quote, a man cannot have his cake and eat his cake. Yes? They were unnecessarily confusing in the past, weren't they?
Yeah. I think so. But yeah. I'm glad that I'm still using idioms from the 16th century.
Yeah, I think it's good that we're making sure people understand what these really mean so they're used properly.
Yeah.
Let them eat cake. Yeah. While the phrase is commonly attributed to Marie Antoinette, I think I attributed it to Marie Antoinette earlier, there are references to it prior to the French Revolution, and historians do not agree that it's likely that she had said it.
That's funny. Cool.
Well, she would have said it in French.
She would have said it. Yeah, she would have said... Dwi ddim yn hoffi cake. Now, listen, until the cows come home, I think that one's appeared on the show before.
I mean, I say a lot.
This one's nice, I like this one. The idiom, till the cows come home, has been in use since at least the 16th century and may have originated in the Scottish Highlands, JJ, where cows were allowed to graze for months at a time before they would meander home in the autumn.
Well, as you well know, cows live inside houses in Scotland.
That's true.
And JJ hates them because they're Scottish.
Part of my mandate is to bring down cows.
Bring down the Scottish cows.
Particularly Scottish ones.
Yeah. No, listen, the farming union, very powerful union in the UK, so just be careful who you offend. Because, listen, if the farmers union write to ask for you to lose your job, then if it's big farmer... attacking
big
us. Then
nice.
It was quite a long
the
way.
Farmers are quite big as well, usually.
They are. I used to work on a farm.
Did you?
I did. I was a farm hand.
What did you do?
I mostly mucked out the pigs. Yeah.
That's what you're good for. Yeah?
Is it true that pigs will eat human bodies if you throw them in there?
Well, I've never thrown a dead human body to a pig. I've watched a few
pieces of modern culture where
you've watched some pieces of modern culture films.
Yes, the TIFO IRL YouTube search history has been odd recently, John. I've got into it
in these series, TV series, usually there's been this trope of we've killed someone. So Deadwood is one of them, right? So Deadwood is set in the Wild West in the Gold Rush era, and they basically in Deadwood, which is a town in wherever, I don't know where it is.
Yeah.
Every time they kill someone, they take the body to this Chinese chap who has pigs, and they just dump it in there, and they get.
Well, it was popularized in Snatch as well, I believe, wasn't it? Was it Brickhouse? Is that his name? The character name of the character, Brickhouse.
I don't know.
He's the guy also in the Armando Iannucci sketch show who Armando Iannucci calls to fix his washing machine. But he's like he's the old Cockney guy that they hire for all those roles. And the sketch is that when he shows up, he just tells the washing machine how he's going to fuck it up. And it starts working again out of a bit of fear.
Recent episode of Silent Witness saw them having to open up a pig to find things in it.
Yeah.
And there was another period drama where this happened as well.
Pride and Prejudice?
It wasn't Pride and Prejudice.
Pig and Prejudice?
Yeah.
Babe 2 was Pig in the City.
Has one of the most terrifying moments in all children's films when the dog attached to the lead gets wrapped around the bridge and falls in the water with just his head in the water. He's going to drown. Babe, hero, saves the dog, but the dog is an evil character. Very terrifying. Made me afraid of drowning.
And Babe 3 is an odd turn in cinematic history when Babe begins eating all of the bodies that are thrown to him.
That's right. Babe 3, a hungry boy.
All I'm saying is, as I was searching for Babe Pig in the City, if you're wondering what's going on the
TV show,
I'll
search.
That's right. Well, listen. It's Bricktop is the name. There we go. Thanks for that, Steve. Well, that's the end. There was a long description of by hook or by crook, but I think we'll leave that one for the listeners.
That's 1380. That's even older. That is old. Quite pleased with that.
To imagine for themselves. Very exciting, isn't it? That's the end of. Is that the end of the show, Steve? I think it is, isn't it?
Where are we? Yes.
It is the end of the show. We've recorded things in a bit of a back around way, but I think for now, this moment, we will say thank you very much to JJ Ball, the Bullard.
Yes.
And also, I've noticed in the comment section, sometimes people think I'm saying bullet. I'm not saying bullet, as in bullard. From a gun. I'm saying bullard.
What is a bullard?
It's something we agreed about a year ago we wouldn't say anymore.
Yes.
Is that a bad thing?
Don't
look it up, people.
No. Let's give John's live reaction to what that is.
Yeah, we won't say it out loud. But we'll just let John look at it on the screen.
Do you need bullard?
No. I'll tell you when it is.
Remember not to talk off your mic, John.
Yeah.
Poor podcast etiquette there.
Yeah, probably best not to mention that, and definitely don't look it up.
It's definitely good if you don't make it someone's nickname.
Yeah,
that sticks forever, isn't it? Mm. Worth saying that I didn't know it meant that when I
did. You think it was like a bullock?
I think so. I think I just said it once.
He was just riffing. Yeah,
just riffing. It came out, and then it stuck. And words, eh? The power of language. Anyway, Jonathan Dog McKenzie.
Search for what that means.
Thank you very
Joe's
much.
Joe's go-to improv word is dog.
Yeah, that's true.
Mine's lizard.
I've definitely done better than you in the nickname stakes, clearly. So, yeah, I'm happy with that. And thank you. Yes. Enjoyed it.
And thank you to Steve Hankels, producer Steve out there. And, of course, to producer Don today as well, who has his head in his hands. Very tired.
I've just found out what bullet actually means.
Yeah. No good, is it?
No.
Not good.
Real bad.
Yeah. Almost as though we shouldn't continue drawing attention to it.
Absolutely.
I think we got away with it. I think we mentioned it once.
I think so.
We got away with it. It's fine.
It's fine. My boy Bullet. Anyway, we'll be back next week. Actually, I won't be. I'm not here next week because it's Les Oscars. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Very theatrical chap such as myself. I must attend the annual event of import. By which I mean I'm going to my cousin's house to stay up late, eat sugary foods, and watch the Oscars. You know? I've done it for 15 years in a row.
Have you seen all the movies that are nominated for Best Pictures?
And I've seen nearly all of them this year. I tried to get the ones in the Best Picture and then like the acting ones.
Mm. Some Who's
going
to win?
Films. I actually don't know, although I think of the Everywhere, Everything, All at Once film. I can't remember
which.
Have you seen The Whale?
I didn't love it. I haven't seen The Whale. I've heard that's an excellent performance from Brendan Fraser, but I have heard that the film isn't. That happens sometimes at the Oscars, by the way.
Is that how you say it?
Fraser? I'm not sure. I've always said it. Fraser.
But Americans say it's Frasier.
Top tip if you are looking at the Oscar categories. If you look at the acting categories and you notice a film, particularly if it's in lead actor, if you notice a film where it's not nominated in any other category apart from that one, you go, okay, that's a performance film where one actor does a terrific job, but the film's just fine, you know? I try to avoid watching
those. And that film is Babe 3.
I thought his turn as the cannibal pig was very impressive, but the film leaves something
to be desired. God, that pig can act.
Do you not think if they did like a horror version of Babe, it would actually go down quite well? Especially if they didn't... they didn't sell it as a horror film and there's just kids like probably eating their popcorn and yeah. then it just becomes...
I think there'd be a high take-up for that.
Yeah.
I should say, though, my favourite film of the year was the Moon Age Daydream, the David Bowie documentary. That was... Have you guys seen that?
No.
Oh, it was terrific. Also, no. It was so good. I don't think it's nominated for any Oscars, but that's not what the Oscars are about, really, you know. What was you got a favourite film of the year?
I just like watching Dumb and Dumber, mostly.
Dumb and Dumber?
Yeah.
Yeah. You are a kind of old joke guy, aren't you?
Yeah.
Sort of, yeah.
References to things that I know from the 90s, yeah.
Joke guy. Did you not enjoy Top Gun Maverick? Have you seen that one?
Yeah, it's probably one of the best films ever made. It'd be right up there with Jurassic Park.
Yeah?
It's magic.
Do you really think so?
I think movies...
It's on my list to watch this week. I haven't watched it yet.
So, like, you haven't seen it?
No.
Oh, see, this is the thing, right? So, and again, I've watched lots of movies for my degree that I did.
Yeah.
And
always got to get that in there.
No, well, it's the thing, because people always like, movies are meant to be this arty thing that makes you feel something, and that's nice, but I like to avoid feeling things, because then I have to think about life, really.
Yeah, so if
I just have things in the middle, that's fine.
Yeah.
And Top Gun, you don't have to feel too much, it's just a thing that happens. You're like, wow, I'm on a roller coaster ride, but it's an abject, it's amazing.
Right.
And they've done it very well. It's just a perfectly put together movie, like, to watch like that. I call it a movie rather than a film. You know, a film's like Citizen Kane, that's a film.
Yeah.
Whereas... I think it's brilliant, yeah. I mean, it's like, we both like Jurassic Park, right?
I think Jurassic Park's maybe one of the best films ever made.
Me too.
Yeah.
And it's in there, and I watched Top Gun, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe how good that is.
Oh, I'll watch it this week. Fine. What's your favourite film of the year, John?
I can't even tell you the last time I went to the cinema. But really? At the moment, I'm watching my way through the Star Wars franchise.
Yeah.
Because I really liked the old Star Wars when I was young.
Yeah.
I.e. the original trilogy.
And do you like really the young Star Wars now you're old?
I haven't really watched any of the other ones.
No.
So I'm watching my way through it. Oh, it's interesting. It's like, it's interesting going back through it and being like, oh, there's actually quite a big political backstory here that when you're a kid, you're just like,
the trade discussions are fascinating when you're eight. Yeah.
I
do think John McKenzie's the only person I know who would say, I'm watching the Star Wars series at the moment. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. It's the only person I know who would describe that as interesting.
I think that, like, the political background of Star Wars could potentially have been done quite well, but they didn't do
agree.
It.
Agree.
Because it's quite an ambiguous political background, right? Yeah. It's sort of like there's some bad guys, and then these are the good guys in the original trilogy, and then you go back and it's like, actually there's lots of bad guys all over.
Well,
the
indeed,
place.
I find that in the prequels, the confusion of Count Dooku, very strange, very grey area. As they say, all of the best sci-fi that came out of the Soviet Union times. Maybe it's just a satire of the modern world.
Have you heard the theory that Jar Jar Binks is actually a Sith Lord?
I've not heard that theory.
So there was a real theory that when you describe Sith Lords, they can disguise their real power and do it in comical ways, which is what Jar Jar Binks does. He falls and he's always in the right place at the right time. He's like Lewandowski, right?
Casemiro.
Yeah, he's there. He fills in the gaps. But there was such hatred towards the character and that poor actor who got a load of hatred out of it.
Yeah.
And then so they changed it apparently for later ones. I mean, that might be nonsense, but there's, you know, Star Wars nerds go right into it. I want to know what Dave Filoni and John Favreau say about it, because they would know. Love those guys.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Well, that's probably the end now, isn't it? I would have thought. That's the end. But anyway,
if this makes it in, wow.
I think it will. I think by the time they get to the end, they'll stop. They'll be too tired to do any more editing of things out. But suffice to say, Michael Bailey will be joining you next week for some more football chat. So look forward to that or something. But until then, all the best. Bienvenue. Take care. And, just keep old chugging along until... next time.
Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.